Every time I think of those folks, I think of the 4th of July parade one summer at the in the village, when the people in the tape ministry came as a float in the parade, and they had tape just all over them, strung all over, just one, I mean thousands of yards of tapes all over, and they came as a float entitled the Tapeworms. My name is Larry Rasmussen. I teach social ethics in Washington, D.C. at a Methodist seminary when I'm not here in the village. And this is a session entitled Marx and Marxism, an Introduction. I mentioned at announcements this noon that it's probably true that, at least in the modern world, no person, with the possible exceptions of Jesus of Nazareth, has had more influence than Karl Marx. It may also be true that were Marx alive today, he would have had his version of Freud's judgment on psychotherapy when Freud saw the directions his disciples were taking his thought. Freud said, "I am not a Freudian." It may be the case that Karl Marx would say, "I am not a Marxist," looking at the track record of what has happened to his thought. It may also be that Jesus, looking at the track record, may have said, "I am not a Christian," as well. But Karl Marx is the spring of Marxism historically, and the reach of Marxism is vast. Something like 1.2 billion people, about a third of the human race, lives in Marxist societies. In fact, one-fifth of the human race lives in a single nation that is Marxist, namely the People's Republic of China. So about a third of our neighbors live in Marxist societies. And millions, probably billions more, live in societies that have been deeply influenced by Marxism. They are themselves not establishment Marxist societies, but they have been deeply influenced by Marxism. Western European countries have had a struggle over the years and have usually formed political parties that come out of socialist roots that trace a strong influence to Karl Marx. One doesn't understand, for example, West Germany today apart from the Social Democratic Party. Or even in Scandinavia, in many, many other places, many countries which are not establishment Marxist nonetheless show a very strong influence by Karl Marx. There are furthermore countries which, and societies which really establish their own identity over against Marxism. Sort of, if we didn't have the Russians, we'd have to invent them. President Reagan, for example, and many people in this country see themselves in terms of that which they oppose. And Marxism is a chief element, often philosophy, to which they find themselves opposed. So whether it is the direct influence of Marxism over a couple of billion people, or the indirect influence, or that over against which one finds oneself and identifies oneself, Marxism and Karl Marx have had, and do have, an enormous influence. Marx is also the fountain of ongoing inspiration. Latin American theology, often called liberation theology, the movement now, is indebted to Karl Marx. Many Latin American Christians use as their perspective to understand what's going on in their own society a Marxist analysis, and would identify themselves as Christian Marxists or Marxist Christians, or even when they say we are not Marxists, they often use the tools which Karl Marx as a social scientist provided. Dissidents in establishment Marxist societies are often indebted to Marx for ongoing inspiration. A Dubček in Czechoslovakia and the reform movement there that was crushed with the invasion of the Russians. Dubček identified his reform movement as a Marxist reform movement, or Habermann in the German Democratic Republic, or Polish socialists in Solidarity, the labor union, see themselves as good Marxists in opposition to the establishment Marxism of their governments. This has been very interesting to me because this year is the centenary of Karl Marx's death, 100 years. There has been very little celebration of Karl Marx in establishment Marxist society. Russia made hardly a word and made hardly notice of it. And in many of those countries, the USSR, the German Democratic Republic, other establishment Marxist societies, officially Marxist societies, Karl Marx's early writings have been banned, the economic and philosophical manuscripts. They are reformist and humanistic writings, and they are the source of inspiration for dissident Marxists, and ongoing inspiration. Western universities, especially in Europe, are deeply influenced by their ongoing intellectual life by the writings of Karl Marx. When I was at the University of Berlin, I think Karl Marx was read in West Berlin more than any other single author. And all of this has influenced only over a century or a century and a quarter thus far. Now, we have to do a little bibliographical sketch of Karl Marx, even though our important point or focus here is really his ideas and their power. You don't have to know much at all about Adam Smith in order to understand capitalism. In fact, we don't even call Adam Smith the father of capitalism, because what Adam Smith did was to be a very keen observer and describer of something that was already going on, and that was early capitalism. So Adam Smith is not a generative figure of capitalism. But you do need to know Marx's story, or you don't understand the course of socialism in the modern world. He is a genuinely generative, creative figure, just as you need to know the Jesus story if you need to make any sense of the church's story. Marx is a pathfinder. Smith is not. Doesn't mean Smith didn't do a good job. It's just a different person. Marx is genuinely creative in many arenas, not only in economic life either, whereas Adam Smith is extremely observant in one area, namely economic exchange. And so we say that Adam Smith's book, The Wealth of Nations, is important to understanding capitalism, but Smith isn't. Marx, you got to know something about him as a person. This is only can only be a sketch. I looked in the library. We only have one book in the library about Karl Marx by Franz Mehring, and it is a biography of Marx, so there is that resource there. The only other book we have in there is The Communist Manifesto by Marx and Engels. We don't have much in the library and very little in the bookstore on Karl Marx. In the bookstore, the most you will find is the indirect influence of Marx, or some of it direct, in books coming out of the Christian churches in Latin America and liberation theology. If you want to note a book for further reference, the best biography, both for Marx's life and his ideas, is one by Isaiah Berlin, Karl Marx, His Life and Environment. But a very quick sketch of Karl Marx in terms of ideas, I mean life and ideas. The dates are 1818 to 1883. He was born in Treves in the Rhineland. He was born to Jewish parents in the Rhineland. There had been rabbis on both his mother's side and his father's side. But his father had the whole family baptized as Lutherans. And Karl Marx grew up then with catechism in the Lutheran church. It's very clear from the family history that the conversion of the Jewish family was for matters of assimilation rather than religious conviction. So that whether Jewish or Christian didn't matter a whole lot. In fact, his father, who was a strong influence on him, was influenced by a movement in philosophy called the Enlightenment. And we can talk a little bit about that as it shows up later in Karl. It's characteristic. His father was a lawyer, and his father had a fervor, and it's often said that his father had the fervor of the 8th century prophets, the Hebrew prophets, in his father's criticism of society, just as the prophets were the great critics of society. His father had something of that. His father also had a utopian streak that ran through him, that saw the inevitable arrival of a better social order. So they had the combination in the home then, in the father, of the prophetic critique of society and the passion for a better social order. Karl Marx went to private schools in Trier in the Rhineland, and then he went on to the universities of Bonn and Berlin, and eventually received a doctorate from Jena. Jena is in East Germany now. So the upshot of all this is that Karl Marx had a good, thorough German education. In Berlin, Marx was much impressed with a particular group, the followers of the philosopher who was teaching there, a philosopher by the name of Hegel, H-E-G-E-L, I put these names up here. And there was a group that called themselves the left-wing Hegelians. Marx's early philosophical writings show the influence of these, and you can see something from his father that gets carried on into these writings, because they also are writings that share a deep idealism about what might be, what might be able to come about in human society, combined with a real moral passion, an outrage against injustice that Marx carried with him. Now, I can't unpack all of the key ideas as we go along, but we've got to try and take care of some of them. And there are a couple of things that I want you to note from this university experience of Marx. For the followers of Hegel, consciousness of bondage and freedom unleashes the dynamics of emancipation. That is to say, if you become aware of that which enslaves you, that which holds you, that which binds you, then, and that's the most important thing, that then sets you into a position where you will throw off the fetters. The consciousness of bondage and freedom unleashes the dynamics of emancipation. There is the conviction of this way of looking at things that things are masked over ideologically. It's hard to get into other ideas, but that the dynamics of society are covered over with good reasons for things which people are justifying, which in fact comprise their relationship. That much of the socializing process, both bringing up children and groups telling each other in a society how they ought to behave, is a way of covering over what are more brutal dynamics going on there. And that unmasking what's really going on there is the route to liberation or emancipation. So when women find out what a story patriarchy has been feeding them and for what purpose, then you better watch out. That's a way of, it's a Hegelian translation. When the slaves find out that the slave masters have been telling them that Christianity is a religion that asks them to be obedient, long-suffering, enduring of hardship, and even glorifies in suffering, when they find out that that's the plantation master's way of keeping them in their place, that's the kind of Christianity they're being taught, when they find out, watch out. This was interesting to me when I was a student in seminary in the 60s. There were among a lot of white liberals at the time of the Civil Rights Movement a feeling that when young and aspiring blacks got a college education and participated more in the mainstream of white society, that they would simply join on the white person's terms, that's what would happen. What happened was, when those young blacks, in this liberalizing mood of the whites, started getting a college education, they got mad as hell. They then started unmasking the dynamics that underlay what they had been taught. Well, the Hegelian said, when you start demystifying, that's Marx's term, the realities here, that is the first step on the way to emancipation. So you become more militant and less mainstream than you were when you were down on the sharecropper farm. Now, second idea, this first one is unmasking of underlying relationships that are covered over by the socializing process, much of it through education, and so there's a sharp Marxist critique of education. There's a line in the German Ideology, which is one of Marx's books. It goes like this, and it won't make a lot of sense at first hearing, but let me unpack it. Life is not determined by consciousness, but consciousness by life. That is, the life of the ideas and the life of the spirit itself is grounded in our concrete realities, our everyday relationships, the thing we do with each other all the time and the way our societies are organized. Our specific experience, that's where our ideas, our values, even our life of the spirit is rooted. It's rooted in our material existence. By material existence, I just mean our concrete everyday existence. Parents and children, bosses and workers, salespeople and customers, just everything that is the stuff of our everyday life. That's what Karl Marx means by materialism. Now please note that, because some people say communism is materialistic, or it's materialism, and they think that that means an undue attachment to consumer goods, or a kind of idolatry of the things of this world. That's not what Marx means. Marx just means the stuff of everyday life is where even the life of the mind and the spirit is itself grounded, and that it is there in the specific incarnated social, political, and spiritual processes that you have the determination of how people see things, what their values are, what their perspectives are, what their outlook on life is, what their beliefs are. So to say it again, social existence determines how we see things, our consciousness, not the other way around, that the life of ideas floats around and then it just gets, ideas get incarnated. Now that's Marx's materialism, that he had a break with his teacher Hegel, and Hegel was the one who said it's the life of ideas that are the true reality and they become incarnated. Marx said, no, stand Hegel on the head. It's concrete material realities that people are born into that determines their ideas and their values, their outlook. Okay, a third item, and this is all heavy stuff, and you'll have to ask questions along the way, so please do that when you need to, or ask for examples or whatever. Another thing from Hegel is the notion of the way things are put together in terms of a particular pattern. Thesis, antithesis, synthesis. That's talking about our social existence. And Hegel says, all of nature and all of history, human life, is really filled with the strife of conflicting forces. Some group has power in a society and they try to order things in their own way. It gives rise to counter power. Other people just will go along to some degrees, but they'll oppose it. So the force gives rise to a counter movement or force. And then there's real conflict there. And then as that conflict reaches a particular point, then you may have something new being created out of these forces which are at odds with one another in the society, that something new becomes a synthesis. It's different from either the initial force or the counterforce. As they work in conflict in society, and maybe even by way of compromise, they come to something which is different, and that's a synthesis. That synthesis then, if it becomes dominant, becomes the new thesis. And then it goes on for a while, and then there's some counter-movements, counter-force, and so on. And that's the way it goes. Karl Marx believed that social reality was full of conflict. Lots of them are masked over between men and women, between blacks and whites, but there is conflict there. His method was what is called dialectical materialism. I put it up here. The dialectical part of that refers to the fact that much of our social existence is conflict that moves between poles that are in tension with one another, or groups or that are at odds with one another. We'll try to unpack that a little bit later. In capitalism, it's a conflict between those who own the means of production and those who are the workers. But take an example from something much smaller sphere, sort of the family. Husband and wife, in the course of living together day in and day out, year in and year out, may establish patterns between each other that are really patterns of conflict, where they are not in harmony with one another. Then there's some episode will come up, you know, he left the sock, dirty socks, never picks up his dirty socks, you know. Or he burnt the meal tonight and I had a long day at work and when I came home, what do I get? A burnt meal. So some little episode comes up and some terrific argument follows. It has nothing to do with simply one pair of socks left there. It uncovered a whole pattern that had developed. Maybe it's non-communication between the two people, and there really was conflict there. So Marx said that's the way lots of life is about, and then maybe husband and wife really have it out, thesis, antithesis, and maybe they work it through to something different. And then their relationship is different in some new synthesis. They've come to some other point in their relationship. That becomes the new thesis, and then you go on from there. Well, Marx says that's the way society is put together. All right. We can discuss this with more examples and in greater detail later if we have time. I only want to show the debt of Marx to Hegel at this point, and a few things he learned when he was an undergraduate. Okay. I should mention one more thing here from these days, and that is Marx's critique of religion, which also comes from his undergraduate days with the Hegelians that he identified with. The left-wing Hegelians spoke much about religion, and they had an elaborate critique of the religion that they found. At its simplest, it's like this. Their contention was that religion is a projection by human beings onto a kind of cosmic screen of that which human beings need most in order to cope with the world. If we feel impotence, then we project God as a powerful God who has the power to rescue us. So it's a powerful God that is worshipped by those who feel in a situation of powerlessness. So that the Hegelians see religion then as a human way of projecting onto God that which human beings need themselves in order to cope with things which aren't in their own control. Religion then is a way of coping with what seems or is beyond our control. And Feuerbach, whose name is up here, one of these left-wing Hegelians said then, theology is anthropology. That is to say, when you're talking about God, you're really talking about human beings and what they need in order to get along in the world. If they're going through a time of great suffering, then they see in God that which answers to their suffering in order to allow them to get on with life. So when you're talking about God's reality, you're really talking about human's reality and humanity's efforts to cope with that. And it's not far from John Calvin saying that God knowledge and self-knowledge are corollaries of one another. Now, Karl Marx accepted that understanding of religion, but he took it a step further than Feuerbach. I'll cite the classic passage of Marx on religion. Marx, incidentally, was a very ponderous and tedious writer. You can pick up books by Marx, of which it can rightly be said that once you put them down, you can hardly pick them up again. But not flashy. Sometimes eloquent, more often hard to read. From Marx, religious distress is at the same time the expression of real distress. That is, distress that people are exhibiting in their religious life. If they're in prayer about something which is really distressing them, when he says religious distress, he means the expression of distress in religious life. Religious distress is at the same time the expression of real distress, and it's the protest against real distress. Marx says, religion is often a protest against real distress. We do not want these things, this suffering, to happen to us. Last night there was a prayer for a friend who was dying of cancer. That's a prayer exhibiting the protest against real distress. So Marx goes on. Religion is the sigh of the oppressed creature. Religion is the heart of a heartless world, just as it is the spirit of an unspiritual situation. Religion is the heart of a heartless world. It's where humanity is still holding on to that which cares in the situation which is heartless. The sigh of the oppressed creature. It is the spirit of a spiritless situation. It is the opium of the people. It's the last sentence in that. So, what the Hegelians wanted to do then is to demystify, to expose, to unmask the dynamics of the society in which they were a part. What you're coping with and how it's got hold of you. What Marx did was to say that religion is one way in which people cope with the world. And instead of leaving it at that, like Feuerbach did, and just observing that, Marx said, the criticism of religion is the beginning of the criticism of society. Criticism of the holy family is the beginning for the point for the criticism of the human family. What he means then is that people are projecting into their religious life the conditions that they're having a hard time with in real life, and his criticism of religion is that then does not serve to change the conditions in their real life that people could change. So if plantation owners are telling black slaves that Christianity teaches patience, endurance, long-suffering, forgiveness, their reward will be in the sky by and by, Karl Marx is saying, if they buy that religion and talk about their reward and their freedom when they die, free at last, free at last, thank God Almighty, I'll be free at last, then it takes the edge off of them reforming, changing the master-slave relationship. His criticism of religion is that it then is the opium of the people when they could organize society differently to get rid of the conditions that give rise to the distress. And that's why he also says, if you want to criticize society, you have to criticize the way in which society expresses itself in religious life. We're going to talk tomorrow in Bible study about male-female relationships. Marx would not find it at all surprising that men have said that it is the order of God that man should be head of the house and women should be support system. Because we tend to give divine sanction to that which we order, the way in which we order society according to our designs, if we have the power to do so. And if you want to get at a change in the male-female relationship, then you better get at, Marx is saying, the way in which you've projected that onto the way God's will for the order of things. So the beginning of criticism of religion is the beginning of the criticism of society. The critique of the holy family is the starting point of the critique of the human family. All right, so much for what Marx learned as an undergraduate. When he received his doctorate from the University of Jena, he wanted to pursue an academic career, wanted to be a teacher. But he was considered too radical for a university appointment, and so Marx, like all academics and many clergy, had to find a way to make a living by talking lots. But since he couldn't get a job as a teacher and had this critique of religion that didn't allow him to be clergy, he went into journalism. He became the editor of the Rheinische Zeitung in 1842, but that didn't last long because it was suppressed by the authorities in 1843. Now, you have to know that this is a time of much revolutionary ferment in Europe. 1848 was a year of outbreak of revolution in many countries in Europe. So there was both revolutionary activity and lots of radical ideas around and movements. At the same time, the authorities were watchful everywhere, and they closed down the paper. Marx went in 1843 to Paris to study socialism firsthand. He is the founder of Marxist socialism, but there are many kinds of socialisms. And there were lots of them already in their infant stages, and he went to study some of them in Paris. This is probably the decisive time in Marx's life, from 43 to 45 in Paris, for a couple of reasons. It's his first-hand involvement in socialism as an aspiring reality, and it's the meeting of and the beginning of a lifelong career of collaboration with Friedrich Engels. Name is up here. Engels was to Marx what Melanchthon was to Luther. Marx, as an activist socialist, a couple words about that first. There are many kinds of socialism at this time, as I mentioned. Socialism arises in response, or arose in response to the negative realities of the Industrial Revolution. That is, socialism arose as a criticism of early industrial capitalism. The working conditions where you had forced child labor for 12, 15 hours a day. We had terrible working conditions, pollution, the sweatshops, etc. Socialism arose from within capitalism as a reform movement, or in some cases an effort to overthrow it and substitute something else. And Marx went there to Paris to study that. He continued his journalism while in Paris in a German language paper, but the Prussians were still after him, and they prevailed upon the French to expel him in 45, even though he wasn't in Germany. They convinced the French to get rid of them. He went to Brussels, where with Engels he found himself for the very first time in his life as the head of a party organization, a socialist party organization. So he begins to try to put his ideas into practice, and from this time on both he and Engels are deeply involved in party organization and activity. He comes to the conclusion after these few years at being a part of socialist movements that it's only with the rising of the proletariat, as he calls them, that the socialist revolution is going to come off, that socialism is going to be reality. That means essentially the workers at this time. It'll mean workers and farmers or peasants later on. I maybe should interject something here. It's at this time that he's writing the economic and philosophical manuscripts, which are mostly noted for their deep humanism and their moral ardor and their moral concern. Alienation, a key Marxist term, shows up now. It means that human beings are being separated from the objects of their creativity, and thus are themselves suffering as a spirit in that. Marx sees human beings as relentlessly creative. We're always trying to express ourselves in the things we make and do. It's our nature to be relentlessly creative. The other way in which Marx sees us is intrinsically social. We are who we are in our relationships with other people. So there isn't any way of understanding being a child apart from being related to a parent. Or understanding you can't be wife apart from being related to husband. Everything is a matter of social relationships, our own identity. We're relentlessly creative and we're intrinsically social. Now, alienation means that we are cut off from that we create. And that is a killing of the very essence of being human. And what he saw was workers who only had such a small part in some process of creating something that then they didn't have any control over or any further part in. They put on the bolt, or they put in two pins. And he saw that destructive of the human spirit. Alienation becomes the key term now, and the lumba and the human fulfillment becomes a key goal in his time in Brussels. He's also aghast at conditions in the factories, and he has a special concern for what he called the lumpen proletariat, which he refers to, interestingly enough, as the Lazarus stream or stratum of the working class. That is, there are people in society who are the Lazarus stratum, for whom the spirit as well as the body is decimated, who have lost all will to live, who are simply apathetic, who have no get up and go, and he attributes that to the conditions of the society in which they are a part. They have no fight left. I want to underline this, that for Marx at this time, socialism is first of all a moral critique of capitalism. And it is only secondarily, although importantly, also the beginnings of a vision of a different kind of society. But if you don't understand that Marx is morally outraged at the conditions of the society, then you don't understand the birth of Marxist socialism. It's at this time also that he turns them to the workers and becomes a part of organizational matters. He never lost his preoccupation with the world of ideas that he was trained in, but now ideas are always instrumental. That is to say, the ideas are to serve certain commitments to a different kind of society. And the London Center for the Communist League asked Karl Marx to write a definitive statement of its beliefs. And the result of that was a little booklet called The Communist Manifesto. That was the occasion. Wrote it as a service to an organization. We won't take much time with it. You'll find things in the Communist Manifesto that will surprise you. Radical things called for, like public education, graduated income tax, are called for in the Communist Manifesto. You will also find in the Communist Manifesto the writings of one who stands in awe of capitalism for its productive virtuosity. Marx's criticism of capitalism was not that it was inefficient. He thought it was an enormously efficient economic system for producing goods and services. Listen to this from the Communist Manifesto. The bourgeoisie, that is the capitalist, during its rule of scarce 100 years, has created more massive and more colossal productive forces than have all preceding generations together. Subjection of nature's forces to man, machinery, application of chemistry to industry and agriculture, steam navigation, railways, electric telegraphs, clearing of whole continents for cultivation, canalization of rivers, whole populations conjured out of the ground. What earlier century had even a presentiment that such productive forces slumbered in the lap of social labor? Marx is in awe of capitalism's power to produce. And his criticism isn't its inefficiency. Its criticism is what it does to the human spirit. Well, 1948 was a year of abortive revolutions, and Marx was in on a lot of them. When fighting broke out in Cologne, Germany, he went there. He went back to Germany now to get in on the socialist revolutions. He edited a radical paper called Neue Rheinische Zeitung, addressed to the working class. He asked the folks to refuse to pay their taxes in protest to the working conditions. Authorities arrested him for treason. Marx had studied law earlier, and he used the trial then both for his own defense, he became his own lawyer, and also for an opportunity to instruct the jury about the conditions of German society. Now, not only was he acquitted, but the foreman of the jury thanked him for his instructive teaching about German society. Well, the Prussian government couldn't annul the verdict. It was their court that had acquitted him. But they could deport him, so they did that. And he went to Paris again, but he was unwelcome because the Prussians managed to convince the French government again that he ought not to stay there. And in 1849, Karl Marx went to London, where he was to remain the rest of his life. To my knowledge, he never set foot in Russia. He spent his life in Germany and Paris and sometime in Belgium and a lot of it in England. Well, for whatever reasons, he did not pursue his party activism in London, even though there was lots going on among competitive socialist groups there. Instead, he went to the library, like all good academics eventually do after their spasm at trying to change the world firsthand. And he holed up in the basement of the British Museum. After having written that the purpose of philosophy was not simply to understand the world, but to change it, he proceeded to write the theoretical analysis and framework for both explaining and changing the world. And the product of that research in the basement of the British Museum was an enormous tome called Das Kapital, Capital, first published in 1867. He raised a family. He is said to have been an exemplary father and a loving husband, although they were a poor family because he had to eke out a living with this journalism in exile. He scratched out a living of sorts by writing as a European correspondent for the New York Tribune. The editor of the New York Tribune was Horace Greeley, and Horace Greeley, go west, young man Greeley, was Karl Marx's boss. Engels, whose father had a textile plant, good capitalist incidentally, had a textile plant in Manchester, England, also contributed to the income for the Marx family in the worst times there. There are some lovely letters from Jenny Marx, Karl Marx's wife, to Friedrich Engels for thanking him as a friend for helping out after Karl Marx died. Marx did enter socialist politics one more time, and he became both the organizer and the head of the International Working Men's Association. It reinforced his earlier conviction that the workers had to be the bearers of the revolution. The association grew, and when Marx died in 1883, he was a world-renowned figure, both for his ideas and for his political leadership. But he never returned to his homeland, and his grave is on English soil. Karl Marx is buried in a grave on the outskirts of London. Okay, our time is about up, and I do want to leave some time for you to ask some questions. I think I'm going to add one more thing, because what we think of as Marxism is Marxism as it has been revised and as it's been supplemented by Lenin. And so when the Russians talk about Marxism, they never say Marxism per se. They talk about Marxism-Leninism. And there are good reasons for that. Lenin is the organizer of socialism, much more than Marx ever was. He is the one who took up the task of transposing Marxist ideas into structures and organizations. And in this process, the party comes to have a far more important place than it does in Marx. Marx was sympathetic with the workers and wanted to get them organized, but it's Lenin that judges that the proletariat is too easily the victim of what we call false consciousness. They don't know the reality that is mass, that we talked about earlier. They're slaves who accept their lot. So Lenin says the proletariat needs to have a revolutionary elite to lead it. Needs an avant-garde. It needs to be from its ranks, but its job is to provide liberating leadership, a clear-sighted minority with real revolutionary fire and discipline that acts in behalf of the majority. And it needs to then lead the dictatorship of the proletariat. Well, that's a phrase from Lenin. Now, in a Marxist society, a Marxist-Leninist society, the party then becomes important, and the party functions in the state. Now, this place of the state as a central organizing, governing place in a Marxist society is also Leninist, not Marx. There is that phrase a couple of times, the dictatorship of the proletariat, in Marx and Engels. It's very infrequently used, but it is used in some of the literature in 1848 and 1850. But what it means in Marx is rule by the proletariat, and the proletariat is in the majority. Those are most people. So when Marx said the dictatorship of the proletariat, that's another word for majority rule against the small number of capitalists who had the power, minority rule. In fact, Marx and Engels opposed what was called Blanquism. Albert Blanqui argued, as a Marxist, that the revolution has to be led by a revolutionary elite because of false consciousness. And Marx opposed Blanqui and said, no, freedom must go together with democracy. The majority of the proletariat must come to see its own condition and be the vehicle. And Engels ended by saying, we have more to gain by way of the ballot box than by way of guns. It's Lenin who changes this and underscores the role of the avant-garde revolutionary elite that then takes charge of the state, which then becomes the central figure.
What is the Lenin's period?
Well, Lenin's most active period is the early part of this century.
Oh, it is after Karl Marx.
Oh, yes. After Marx has died. Yeah. A lot of modern Marxists now drop Leninism and work at what they call democratic socialism. And the best book by an American who will explain Marx's ideas along this line is by Michael Harrington. He's the best U.S. Scholar of Marx and the leading organizer of democratic socialism. And these are people who say we are closer to Marx than was Lenin's addition. Now, Lenin, however, adds to the corpus of ideas, and I want to explain this, and then we'll have to quit. Maybe I have room for a few sessions, but this is very important for understanding what's happening in Central and South America today, and why Christians, as well as non-Christians there, find Marxism a helpful tool. They find it a helpful tool, one, because it understands society to be made up of conflicting forces that are always, where the conflicts are always masked over, and the power relationships are hidden by those who have power so as to make it look like cooperation when it's really interests at odds with one another. They also adapt Marx because Marx provides the social science tools for getting at those power relationships. And thirdly, they find Marxism attractive, not so much because of what Marx said, but now because of the addition of Lenin. And this is it. Lenin adds to the corpus of ideas of Marx with his theory of imperialism. What Marx talked about as having reality within an economic society, within an economic order of society, Lenin explains on an international scale. That is, Marx says it's the nature of capitalism to always seek new markets and new resources. That is, it's the most important thing about capitalism is that it propels itself by economic growth. If you don't have economic growth, you don't have capitalism. That's the way it runs, Marx says. So it always has to be seeking new markets and resources. The theories of dependency and neocolonialism that one will hear out of the churches in South America have roots in Lenin's theory of imperialism and Marxism's theory about capitalism always needing growth. Lenin says the enterprises of capitalism can postpone the day of reckoning where internal contradictions between those who own production and those who are the workers don't come to conflict because the capitalists can export the contradictions. You can export the problem. excess capital that you gain in a good capitalist order can be invested in developing countries, and by means of that you will get new markets and new resources, and then the workers at home will be relatively better off than they were, and they will be better off than the workers in the developing countries. So they will not oppose in a way that brings about revolution in their own country, but capitalism will continue to grow by using the resources in the markets of, by using, finding new markets. Those new markets provide cheaper labor, and so the Ford company will decide to make part of its parts in Brazil, and then assemble the Ford back here, and the workers back here can get more money because they've used cheaper labor and materials from elsewhere. So it means the workers in advanced countries are relatively well off. The proletariat then is not the vehicle of revolution. The socialist revolution will not happen there, Lenin says, but it will happen in more backward countries where capitalism's contradictions and inherent conflicts are clearest. So that it'll happen more where you have rich and poor in poor countries at odds with one another than where you have relative degrees of rich and poor in advanced countries, because the poor will benefit in the advanced countries from this exporting of capitalism. So it'll be at the points of early capitalism and in developing countries that you'll have the Marxist and the socialist revolution. And Lenin says it's the weakest link in the chain where the break will occur, not the strongest ones. And he adds peasants to workers as a proletariat. Now that's important because no Marxist revolution has ever occurred in an advanced industrial society. They have occurred in societies of infant capitalism or early capitalism, China, Cuba, Vietnam, the Soviet Union itself, and thus some talk also about Central America. It's the internationalizing of capital that rescues capitalism from its internal contradictions and means that the protests against it will happen more likely elsewhere than where capitalism is strongest, because there it can, that can be home and it can move out. And use the developing countries as a source of cheap labor and new markets. Well, our time is about up, and I've monologued on and on here. But let's see what questions you have. That's precious little we didn't get into very much.
Larry,
yeah.
You're saying that capitalism is breeding socialism in other countries.
That's the contention of well, that would be the contention of both Marx and Lenin, but especially of Lenin, yeah. That socialism would arise in protest against capitalism.
And that's not a going thing. Would it stop?
Well, at some point, I mean, the conviction is that at some point capitalism breeds its own destruction. It is the thesis which gives rise to an antithesis, and then in the struggle something else, something different will come, which is beyond capitalism. And Marx saw that as socialism, which is a movement which arises within, which pushes it to some new reality. Now the historical record's a little bit different. Even some socialist revolutions have occurred not just in countries of infant capitalism, but against a kind of feudal order rather than a capitalist order. So that doesn't quite fit with either Marx or Lenin. But you asked about how they would see this. Socialism is a new synthesis. Actually, beyond that is. Actually, it's capitalism is the thesis. It gives rise to these protest movements, which are socialist in form. And then, if it's successful, socialism will give rise to something new, and that's communism. For Karl Marx, socialism and communism are not the same. Communism hasn't yet occurred. What we have is socialism, which eventually, if things go the way he thought they would lead to communism, where then you'd have a dissolving of, in Lenin's term, the state. The state isn't there. What you do in the morning is your work, what you do in the afternoon is fish, and what you do in the evening is read poetry. That's all we know about communism from Karl Marx. It's a utopian picture, but that's the extent of his vision of it. What you have in the meantime is socialism on the way.
I don't know. What's the difference between socialism and communism?
Communism is eventual. It's really a utopian vision where each works according to his or her abilities and contributes, and people receive according to their needs. Socialism is this interim state where you have to organize the society differently, economically. But that is not yet the free working of all according to their wishes and desires and abilities, just being creative as they will, and then people receiving according to their needs. That hasn't happened. But there's a very large difference between that and the interim state of socialism, which requires the use of power and a reorganization of society. Communism is eventual utopian.